He doesn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about second and third order consequences.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, Bulwark contributor. My partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic, is trekking somewhere in Western Canada right now. We do have a very special guest who I'll get to in a minute. But before we bring him on, I do want to get into the jackassery of the week. It's a very target-rich environment. I thought briefly about providing the award to Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent for finding a workaround against the law that prevents any living person from being on U.S. currency. Apparently, the Secretary of Treasury doesn't think that applies to coins, so we will have a dollar coin with Donald Trump's visage on it shortly. I thought about President Trump's own 180 on a 20% toll of shipping coming through the Strait of Hormuz, which, of course, has now been picked up immediately by the Iranians, who are trying to point out that they will be much more reasonable masters of the strait if allowed to control it and will charge much less than the president, who's now reversed himself. But I'm afraid the frequent winner of this award wins again this week, and that is Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, who, in the midst of everything we have going on with war in the Middle East and ongoing war in Europe, the Department of Defense not completely funded, the most pressing issue that he had to devote his attention to was the danger of middle-aged troops in the United States having low testosterone levels and having everybody tested for testosterone and providing the option for hormone replacement therapy for those. I mean, this is a profoundly unserious person, although he's wreaking serious damage on an important institution. I mean, on the more serious side, he's once again blocked the Navy promotion list, taking off people of color and women from the list. So the damage just continues. That's the jackassery for the week. But to turn to more uplifting matters, I have our most frequent guest over the 5 years of Shield of the Republic, Professor Hal Brands, the Kissinger Professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's been a guest frequently. He's a prolific author, and we have a lot to talk about. Hal, welcome back to Shield of the Republic.
Thanks for having me, Eric. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
So let's start. Both of us are historians by trade, and I'm inductive by nature. So let's start with, if we could, with your recent column in Bloomberg about the ongoing conflict in Iran, which has been flaring up again, even since you wrote your piece. It was a terrific piece that made a powerful argument, I thought, that mere material appurtenances of power are not necessarily determinative in conflict, and that strategy is crucial. And you indict the administration for essentially having no strategy in Iran. Could you lay out the argument for our listeners and viewers?
A few years ago, I had the chance to be the editor of a book called The New Makers of Modern Strategy, which is basically the third edition of kind of the Bible of American strategic studies. And one of the contributors was Sir Lawrence Friedman, who had written a pretty hefty tome on strategy himself, where he made the point that strategy is most interesting when it produces results that are different than the going-in balance of power would suggest. And to me, the U.S.-Iran war was a classic example of that. There's no question about the power differential between the U.S.-Israeli coalition on the one hand and then Iran, an isolated rogue regime on the other. And there's no question that, operationally speaking, the U.S. and Israel got the better of the fight with Iran, and it wasn't even close. You know, the U.S. and Israeli air forces basically managed to take control of Iran's skies relatively early in the conflict. They were able to more or less bomb what they wanted. They inflicted severe blows on Iran's military, on its industrial base, on its economy, and so on and so forth. And yet, if you were to judge by the status quo today, July 16th, or certainly by the now defunct MOU that was signed last month, the U.S. lost the war. And the U.S. lost the war in the sense that it was not able to achieve its most important strategic objectives. It wasn't able to topple the Iranian regime, which was pretty close to a stated war aim, if not explicitly a stated war aim. It degraded Iran's military capabilities, but the war demonstrated that Iran was actually able to cause far more damage in the region than the U.S. and its friends had anticipated. And of course, Iran was able to take and hold control of the Strait of Hormuz, thereby administering a shock to the global economy and essentially forcing the Trump administration to make peace on terms that were quite favorable to Tehran. Now, you want to add sort of the caveat here, which is that the war isn't over. It has kicked off again over the past week or so, and we don't know what is coming still. But just based on what has happened so far, you have an outcome that's far more favorable to Iran than you would have expected when the bombing started on February 28th and the regime was decapitated and it very much appeared to be on its back foot. And the argument is that that owed primarily to failures of strategy on the American side and successes of strategy on the Iranian side. Just briefly, the U.S. Bet everything on sort of a short, brilliant war that would produce a rapid Iranian collapse or capitulation. It had very little plan for what would happen after that. It did not consider second-order consequences and worst-case scenarios, like the idea that Iran would be able to inflict a lot of pain on the neighborhood and close the Strait of Hormuz, even though that's a scenario that U.S. planners had worried about for decades. It did not build a political or diplomatic consensus in favor of the war, and that became more costly as the economic price of the war started to mount. And in general, the Trump administration just failed to match the ends that it was seeking to the means that it was willing to commit. The administration embraced wildly maximalist aims, namely the replacement of the regime or the crippling of the regime in Iran, but then was never willing to commit the military or other resources that would have been necessary to bring that about, because that would have been a far bigger, bloodier, costlier military operation than the Trump administration was willing to withstand. On the other side of it, the Iranians did fairly well. They made lots of mistakes, and we can go into that. But basically, they accomplished two things. They figured out how to weaponize asymmetric advantages vis-a-vis the United States, geography of the Strait of Hormuz being perhaps the best example of that. And I think they basically understood Trump better than Trump understood them. And they understood that if they could protract their retaliation, if they could continue to inflict costs on the U.S. and global economy, Trump would ultimately lose stomach for a fight that was going to be painful for him economically and politically. And again, as of mid-June into early July, that judgment was correct. We'll see where things go from here now that the fighting has kicked off once again.
Yeah, and you make the point in your piece, which something Elliot and I have talked about as well, that the Iranians are perfectly capable of overplaying their hand. You also make the point that, you know, when the shooting stops, you know, may take a while or maybe kind of delayed reaction inside Iran, which has enormous problems to manage, that could, you know, bring about a political or social change in Iran. We just don't know. All very fair. You just made the, you know, point that I wanted to draw you out on. You cite this as a, on the Trump administration's part, as a failure of strategic empathy, an inability to really put yourself in the adversary's position, have a sense of what they might do. And my sense is this just compounded all the other you know, deficiencies of strategy that you mentioned, the short war illusion, the failure to think through what, you know, could go wrong and what might go wrong, the lack of a process really to even do that. But without being able to think about how, you know, it's an iterative process, the enemy gets a vote, as you know, and the administration just seemed incapable, I would argue, either in its conduct of the war or in its conduct of diplomacy, because one could make the same argument about the MOU, that looking at the language on the Strait of Hormuz, for instance, you and I think looking at that would immediately say, this is a capitulation to the Iranians and it allows them to control the strait. So it's not exactly a surprise, I guess, that once this went into effect, that the Iranians would think they get to control the strait, which turns out to be something that Trump finds unacceptable.
Just to pick up on your point about strategic empathy, I think this is exactly right. And the example that I mentioned in the piece is all this reporting indicating that Trump and Hegseth and others were just shocked that the Iranians responded in the way that they did, by going after energy infrastructure, by really inflicting a lot of pain on the UAE, by closing the Strait of Hormuz, because their reference point was, well, we hit them back in June 2025, and they settled for this performative missile launch at a U.S. military base in the region, which was easily defended, and so on and so forth. So they expected that that would be the style of the Iranian response. Once again, apparently not realizing that once the U.S. and Israel began the war by successfully targeting so many high-level Iranian leaders, including the supreme leader, that that would turn this into an existential crisis for the regime, and the regime would lose any incentive not to close the strait, any incentive not to do the things that it would only do as sort of last-ditch survival strategies. And so, again, it's just sort of a story of incoherence with a U.S. administration that does not seem particularly capable of relating sort of the tactical moves in the conflict to the larger strategic vision of what it's trying to achieve. And I think a lot of that does flow back to this issue of deficient process, where, again, based on what we know, a lot of decisions about Iran were made in a very close circle of advisors. Trump actually did some sort of some theater internally at a certain point to try to disguise the fact that he had already made the decision to attack. But what that means is that there's less opportunity to stress test assumptions, to vet judgments that may be mistaken. And thus you get an administration that is surprised by things that U.S. planners in government, in think tanks, pundits had literally been predicting and worried about for decades.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, too, I think a combination of, you know, the short war illusion and the strategic empathy is evident in the clear apparent view that Trump had going into this, which is that this would be just like what he did in Venezuela with Maduro. That sort of, you know, a quick in and out in a theater very close to home where we, you know, completely control everything in the Caribbean, with a kind of kleptocratic regime that doesn't, you know, has an ideology, but it's not a religious ideology to begin with, that you could replicate this with Iran and that it would, you know, lead to exactly the same result when it was like apples and oranges.
I think we are likely to look back on January 3rd, 2026, as the turning point in Trump's foreign policy, and perhaps not in a good way. Venezuela was a big achievement in strategic terms. It was, you know, this dramatic military raid that succeeded, perhaps narrowly succeeded, but still succeeded without any U.S. combat casualties, managed to pluck Maduro basically out of his bed in the middle of the night and bring him to Manhattan for a trial, and also succeeded strategically in a way that I'm not sure is fully appreciated now, in essentially turning Venezuela into a vassal state run by Marco Rubio from Washington. And people can debate whether they think that is sort of morally or legally a good thing, but just in terms of reorienting that country strategically, it was quite an achievement. But I think it created a little bit of a strategic sugar high in Washington, and it convinced Trump that there were very few things that American power and his own daring could not achieve. And it led in quick succession to the two biggest errors of Trump's presidency. The first was going into high gear on Greenland, which happened just a few days after the Maduro raid and, you know, ultimately ended in a U.S. climb down, but not until it had left really deep scars on the NATO alliance to a degree that I think most Americans don't actually appreciate. And then second, informed Trump's decision to start talking very tough toward the Iranian regime when they were murdering protesters in early January 2026 in a way that set in motion the chain of events that ultimately led to the war that began on February 28th. And so you have these two misfires in Trump's foreign policy that I think trace back to the confidence he felt coming out of a clear success story. I've been being very critical of the administration here, and the administration deserves it. But I do want to flag one thing that I think is important to keep in mind, which you mentioned earlier, which is that in the Iran case in particular, the Iranians can still screw this up. And they may be in the process of screwing this up. And in my view, that the MOU was so favorable to Iran that if Iran had just sort of kept that bargain intact and played for time, the U.S. was going to get tired of having a super heavy naval and military presence in and around the Persian Gulf indefinitely. You would have to rebalance to other theaters at some point. And then Iran would have had all of the leverage, and it could have periodically taken shots at ships and gotten a lot of the benefits from control of Hormuz. But the Iranians reacted very strongly when the U.S. tried to open the Omani channel through the Strait of Hormuz, I think fearing that they would lose some of their leverage if they did not. And they pushed it so hard that now we're back in a pretty significant shooting war. It is not at all predetermined how that's going to come out. I think it's still a pretty tough scenario for the United States, to be candid, in part because energy stockpiles are so much lower now than they were when the first war began back at the end of February. And that puts a clock on the conflict that may not play to Trump's advantage. But if the Iranians were to overplay their hand, as in some ways they may have, it would not be the first time that success in one context has led to overconfidence or hubris even that does you in the next time around.
Yeah, I would argue that in both cases, it's kind of a strategic moral hazard, right? You know, a success somewhere leads you to think success is inevitable, you know, down the road and leads to greater acceptance of risk when maybe it's not warranted. I want to tie this section up before we move on to another terrific essay that you and Michael Beckley have written. You talk about the president being not just a-strategic, but anti-strategic, which I think is a very good description here. Could you talk just a little bit about that before we turn ourselves to larger geopolitical issues?
Trump is not a leader who engages systematically in what we would think of as the classic tasks of strategy. He does not like long-term planning. He doesn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about second and third order consequences of actions. He doesn't systematically assess trade-offs between particular issues. He's a gut player. He operates on instinct. He'll do something and then sort of see if it works. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, then he will reverse course. And he relies a lot on just superior U.S. power to help him get his way. And he had a number of successes with that in his first year in office. And that approach can work fairly well when you're dealing with a totally outmatched adversary like the Maduro government in Venezuela, or dependent actors like U.S. allies, and you can kind of shove them around a little bit. But it doesn't work so well when you're dealing with a more dug-in, tenacious adversary that is capable of putting together an effective strategy of its own. And that's exactly what Trump ran into in the second Iran war of his presidency. And so for a long time, Trump's freewheeling style hadn't really cost him because he was mostly punching down against weaker adversaries, because he was working in context where the price wasn't that high. But I think this was the case that really exposed the limitations of that approach.
Couldn't agree more. Let's turn to your recent article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs with Michael Beckley, which is called Heartland versus Rimland. We had you on when your book, Eurasian Century, came out, which was an effort to resuscitate a lot of geopolitical thinking, a lot of which originates at the turn of the 20th century and the middle of the 20th century. Could you talk a little bit for our audience about the origins of some of these concepts of heartland and rimland and how you see it playing out now in this new post-unipolar period that we've entered?
The heartland-rimland dichotomy comes mainly out of the writings of two early 20th century geopolitical thinkers, Halford Mackinder, a Brit, and Nicholas Spykman, a Dutch-American sociologist by training, who got into geopolitics in the run-up to World War II. And essentially, just to kind of condense the story a little bit, when we talk about the heartland, we're basically talking about Russia, Central Asia, and then some of the areas immediately contiguous to that. And then the Rimland is basically the eastern and western flanks of Eurasia, and then the island nations that are located off the coasts. And Mackinder and Spykman argued with each other, and occasionally, in Mackinder's case, with himself, over whether the primary danger to global order came from a heartland power or heartland coalition sort of pushing out to Eurasia's margins and beyond. Think of that as the Cold War scenario, or aggressive Rimland powers like Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, who could strike in both directions. They could push into the Eurasian interior while also pushing outward over the adjoining oceans. And that was the World War II scenario, eliding a few nuances. But that was essentially the pattern, in one way or another, of 20th century geopolitics, where three times you had coalitions of Eurasian aggressors. So in World War I, the Central Powers, and in World War II, the Tripartite Pact, in the Cold War, the Soviet Union and its allies, that were essentially trying to dominate Eurasia or key parts of it, and then use that as a platform for global power projection. And in each case, those coalitions were beaten back by rival coalitions, which included threatened powers within Eurasia, but then with the backing of the offshore powers, Great Britain, and then, of course, the United States, in all three of those conflicts, ultimately makes the decisive contribution. So that's kind of the framework that traditional geopolitics gives us for thinking about the world. And the point that Mike Beckley and I made in the article that you mentioned is that the current age is both similar and different from what has come before. It's similar in the fact that you have another coalition of Eurasian aggressors that are trying to dominate key regions and shift the balance of power globally: Iran, Russia, North Korea, China, and then there are various fellow travelers. And they are again facing off against a Rimland coalition that is led by the United States and characterized and constituted primarily by U.S. alliance blocs in the Western Pacific and in Europe. So in that sense, the geopolitical map of the 21st century looks very similar to the map of the 20th century. But a couple of things have changed. The first is that, and the most obvious is that the Rimland Coalition is more divided now than it was in many previous eras. There is significant uncertainty about whether the U.S. remains committed to the defense of its European allies. There's maybe a little bit less ambiguity, but still some, if you're thinking about the Western Pacific, we've seen trade fights and disputes over Greenland and other things drive wedges within the Rimland Coalition. So that coalition looks a bit shakier than it did at most stages of the Cold War. And the, what we call the Heartland Coalition, which is stretching the term a little bit, but I think gets at the core of it, looks different than previous sets of aggressors, did. Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, on the one hand, they are not threats to sort of militarily overrun the globe or large swaths of it in the way that Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan did in the late 30s and early 40s. There is one statistic we quote that Russia has literally moved at far less than a snail's pace across Ukraine over the past 4.5 years, which gives you a sense of the limits of Russian military power. But they boast advantages that previous sets of Eurasian aggressors did not have. Primarily connectivity, and they are connected to the Rimland world in a way that allows them to wield coercive leverage that would have been difficult for, say, the Soviet Union to do. Think about the coercive economic leverage that China can wield through rare earth export controls and other coercive methods. Think of the way that China is pursuing both traditional and new age spheres of influence. So if you look at what it's doing on its border with Bhutan and India, or what it's doing in the Western Pacific, that looks a lot like a traditional spheres of influence project. At the same time, it's building a digital sphere of influence that encompasses large swaths of the global South. And so there are critical differences in the rival coalitions that put a new twist on geopolitical competition in this era, even though at first glance, a lot of the basic geographical patterns look similar.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me about the article that I found actually encouraging is, despite, as you say, the divisions that the Rimland Coalition faces, you make a pretty powerful case with Mike that the Rimland Coalition, still, when you look at it in detail, despite, you know, China's incredible productive power, despite its near monopoly on rare earths, when you look across the spectrum of economic activity and capability, the Rimland Coalition really is a lot stronger than the axis of adversaries, whatever you want to call the Heartland Coalition, if it could successfully harness all of that in a coherent way with, to go back to our earlier conversation, with a kind of shared strategy. Could talk about that a bit, if you would.
The Rimland is rich in power, but fractured in purpose. And so almost regardless of how you measure it, whether you're just looking at very blunt measures of GDP or more sophisticated measures that give you a sense of financial power and innovation power and things like that, the U.S. plus the other members of the Rimland community, and here I'm speaking just of the formal treaty allies in Europe and the Western Pacific, the imbalance is even greater if you throw in India, if you throw in Vietnam, if you throw in some of the Gulf states that are aligned with the United States more than they're aligned with the other side, even though they're not formally allied to the United States as some of the treaty partners are. The Rimland has a big lead, and it is in many ways more significant than you would expect just by reading the headlines. The same is true of military power. The U.S. plus its allies should be capable of dealing with the military threats that Russia and Iran and China pose simultaneously. The challenges, I think, are twofold. One is that for years and years and years, neither the U.S. nor its allies were putting forth the degree of effort, military and otherwise, that would be required to deal with this multi-theater threat. In the United States, military spending has long been around 3% of GDP, which is among the lowest levels since the end of World War II. We all know the problems of burden sharing the U.S. has had in Europe and in the Western Pacific. But also in part because it's just difficult for reasons of geography, for reasons of politics, and now sometimes for reasons of U.S. policy to get all of the Rimland allies on the same page. And so you can imagine a very powerful collective response to Chinese economic pressure, to Chinese industrial overcapacity. The challenge is we're just not there yet in terms of getting the actual coordination that would allow the U.S. and its friends to push back. And I, Mike and I got a lot of mileage out of a piece that Rush Doshi and Kirk Campbell wrote about this, where they basically made the argument that if the U.S. and its friends can generate allied scale, they're easily able to deal with China on industrial and other issues. But if they can't, then they're in danger of being picked off one by one. I think that that's the biggest uncertainty I have with respect to my analysis of where the two coalitions stand at the moment.
But you also make the point that the access of adversaries does not, as the Soviet Union did with its satellites during the Cold War, have a common ideological framework. It's really much more of a transactional set of adversaries. They work together kind of, you know, up to a point, but not, you know, they're not willing to take certain risks on behalf of one another. You also make the point that there are some differences of interest among them, which could be exploited by the Rimland Coalition. Can you just talk briefly about that?
So obviously, these are four very different types of autocratic regimes, if we're thinking about the governments in Beijing, Pyongyang, Moscow, and Tehran. And that is a source of both strength and weakness for the revisionist entente or the axis of autocracies or whatever one wants to call it. It's a weakness in the sense that ultimately these countries probably have pretty different visions of the future from one another. And in particular, it's hard to understand how Russia and China can accomplish their neo-imperial objectives simultaneously, since they're likely to be rivals for influence in a lot of the same places, from Central Asia to the Arctic. I think you can make the same point about Russia and Iran. There's a long history of tensions between governments located in Russia and governments located in what we would now call Iran, dating back a few centuries. And so there is less cohesion, less solidarity in these relationships than there historically has been in U.S. alliances. And that goes double when you think about the relationships with sort of the outer rings of the autocratic entente. When Maduro gets snatched out of Venezuela, you know, he gets thoughts and prayers from Moscow and Beijing. There's no real help that's forthcoming. The way in which it's a source of strength, though, is that it means that there really aren't any doctrinal disputes to speak of. The Soviet Union and China ultimately fell out during the Cold War as much from ideological disputes, arguments over de-Stalinization, and who should be the standard bearer ideologically within the communist camp, as they did as a result from geopolitical frictions. There are just none of those disputes within the revisionist camp today. Yes, there are frictions that have to do with the fact that Russia is very much becoming a junior partner to China. And China is behaving in ways that I'm sure seem somewhat overbearing to officials in Moscow. But there's a greater flexibility ideologically to these relationships precisely because these regimes do not come from a common ideological heritage.
Let me just tie up this section before we turn to your most recent edited volume that I want to get into. What's the policy prescription here? I mean, obviously, you already talked about some of the damage that the Trump administration has done to the, you know, to the Rimland Coalition by green, you know, the fixation and obsession with Greenland. President just repeated this the other day by posting a picture of himself in a meeting in the Oval with a map that's got the, you know, stars and stripes superimposed on Canada and Greenland. What do you see as the prescription for, you know, dealing with all of this?
In some ways, if we could just stop digging, we would be in decent shape. And I want to give the Trump administration some credit. Some of the things it did during the first year were actually potentially quite constructive when it comes to strengthening and shoring up this Rimland coalition. And, you know, the Trump administration got European officials to agree to far higher levels of defense spending than had ever been contemplated in the last couple of decades. Yes, the Russian threat had something to do with that, but the Trump shock had something to do with it as well. We saw similar movement in a number of countries in the Western Pacific. That's all to the good. And even though the trade deals that Trump signed with countries like Japan and South Korea were not particularly popular domestically because they involved these huge investment pledges and asymmetrical tariff rates and things like that, in their more candid moments, some officials from those countries will say, look, we understand that a degree of American reindustrialization is actually a collective good if you don't want the future world economy to be dominated by China. And so we understand the need to pool capital and pool capabilities in ways that these agreements perhaps point the way toward over time. The problem is that the Trump administration, it could not bring itself to simply declare victory over the allies and come home. And instead had to keep pushing on a variety of issues that have really thrust U.S. alliances, particularly NATO, into a state of permacrisis. There was Greenland, which we've talked about. There was the overt and explicit U.S. intervention in the Hungarian elections this spring, which again was a much bigger deal in Europe than I think most Americans realize. There was the Iran war, which led to a lot of raw feelings on both sides of the Atlantic. And there will be more to come. And so the first thing we have to do is just put a lid on some of these crises, because if we don't do that, there will be zero of the strategic cohesion and strategic trust that has traditionally inhered in these alliances left by the time we get to 2029. And that will make it harder even for whoever succeeds Trump to put together the more cohesive Rimland coalition that we're going to need.
Hal, we have a little less than 10 minutes left, but I would remiss if I didn't draw our viewers and listeners' attention to the geopolitics of AI, the most recent edited volume you've done in a series that's included one on geopolitical implications of COVID. There's been one on the China problem. There's been one on the war in Ukraine, and now one on AI. I can tell folks that it is an incredibly comprehensive examination of the potential role that AI could play in geopolitics. Very well worth folks reading. It also has the benefit of the fact that the ebook is downloadable for free. So I encourage people to go to the Johns Hopkins University Press website and find it there. Talk a little bit about the conference, the book, how it came about, and some of the main takeaways.
For the last few years, an endeavor that I'm part of called the America and the World Project, America and the World Consortium, rather, has run annual conferences each spring on some pressing geopolitical issue, whether the war in Ukraine or the geopolitics of artificial intelligence. And we try to get just a bunch of interesting people together, ask them to answer interesting questions, and then make the results available in an edited volume that is typically available for free online, as you mentioned. And so this time around, I think I assembled 17 or 18 experts, some of them just interesting academics, some of them think tank types, some of them policy types, a couple of folks from the tech world to just wrestle with big questions about how AI will affect geopolitics and geopolitics will shape the development of AI. And so it's a really interesting collection of essays. You know, we have people who think about what is AI going to mean for the future balance of economic power? What will AI mean for dispelling or thickening the fog of war? How will AI shift the balance of power, not just between the United States and China, but between states and non-state actors, whether those non-state actors are corporations or Mexican drug cartels? Things of that nature. How will AI affect strategic interaction when you have AI agents that may actually be determining or at least suggesting the moves and counter moves in a U.S.-China standoff over Second Thomas Shoal in the South China Sea or something like that. So the insights that the essays offer are very rich. I certainly can't do justice to them here, but I would just encourage folks to take a look. You know, there's not much self-interest here since I'm not getting any royalties from this book, but a lot of the essays are extremely interesting and definitely repay the effort to read them.
If you could just talk just briefly about one particular aspect, because I think a lot of people are worrying about this problem, which is kind of first mover advantage and how much of a role that plays. You know, if we fall behind the PRC, you know, what will happen? The virtues of the closed systems we have versus open systems that they're using and the cost that our systems have compared to some of theirs. If you could just briefly talk about that.
The way I'd summarize it, and again, I should be clear that there were a variety of authors who tackled this issue, and they might not all agree with each other or the way I phrase this here, but first mover advantage ain't nothing, but it's not everything either. And so it's easy to think of ways in which getting to a certain technological threshold first can be helpful geopolitically, strategically, and so forth. And the best example of this rolled out just as we were having the conference, and this is Mythos. And so, you know, this is the latest Anthropic model, among other things. It is a very powerful cyber tool with a superhuman ability to sniff out and potentially exploit flaws and vulnerabilities in code. And it's absolutely important that it was an American company and not a Chinese company that reports to the CCP that hit this milestone first, because that gives the US valuable time to learn what these new capabilities can do to help private sector firms and the government get their cyber shields up. And there's absolutely a cost to not having that advantage. At the same time, I think what people who have studied innovation and its adoption over time would stress is that being the first to get to a certain technological threshold is no guarantee that you will dominate that technology and its fruits over time. That's true if you think about tanks and aircraft carriers in the first half of the 20th century. It may also be true in thinking about AI today, because you know, you don't simply have to develop the technology. You've got to figure out a way of harnessing it and diffusing it within your institutions. Your militaries have to adapt, training and doctrine to reflect the impact of new technologies. And so there are a bunch of things that determine technological advantage that don't necessarily have a whole lot to do with who gets across a particular finish line first. Now, it's complicated because of the issue of recursive self-improvement. And this is the idea that very powerful AI will essentially be able to improve itself indefinitely. And so if you develop a really, really good model, it'll just keep improving itself and your lead will get bigger and bigger and bigger over time. There are technical debates over whether that is likely to happen, how big the impact is likely to be. But it doesn't change the fact that to harness AI for military purposes, you still got to figure out ways of getting your institutions, your military institutions, to embrace and adopt new technologies. And so even if we're living in a world of recursive self-improvement, there's a lot more to establish establishing technological advantage over time than simply crossing some finish line first.
Hal, we could go on for hours, but you've already been very generous with your time. We're going to make sure that we have links to the AEI website that has your Bloomberg piece, to Foreign Affairs, and to Johns Hopkins University Press for this really terrific compendium of stuff on AI and geopolitics. But thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.